Nothing. So I can, if I'm into something, I do, I'm an extremist, I guess.
Right.
Honestly, I've never really thought of Crokinole as a game that would appeal to extremists. But I guess it kind of fits. It's all about finding and inhabiting your zone, that place of calm, composed, almost unthinking focus. Just sitting there, aiming for a perfect shot to fill a void right at the center. The final game itself will be hushed. The players will be quiet, focused, barely moving. But still, there's a palpable feeling of intensity. But trying to capture the electricity of this moment, it's a bit like trying to cover a big consequential putt in a golf tournament. You've got to whisper from beside the green. There's no play-by-play. There's no obvious scoreboards. Instead, we've got tournament organizer Nathan Walsh holding court in the timekeeper's box at center ice. He's surrounded by glass, perched on a chair, holding a microphone.
We're getting ready for the World Crokinole Championship Finals in 2025, and two first-time finalists, Sean Haggerty versus Devin Fortino.
Meanwhile, I'm on the sidelines, watching with Devin's brother, Dr. Nick.
This is the dream, Devin, in the finals for me.
It kind of blows my mind, too. I don't know. I don't understand it.
Devin's opponent, Sean Haggerty, has been playing on the competitive circuit for a few years now. He's an engineer by trade, but now he is the vice president of a lawnmower company. He actually holds the unofficial record for the most 20s made in a row. He filmed himself hitting an astounding 83 consecutive bullseyes. The best I've made? 8 in a row. And I was pretty happy about that. I still am.
And the match is underway. Sean Haggerty begins, scores an open 20. Devin Fortino, a bit of a pause and shoots long. Hanger 20 chance here for Fortino. Makes it. Ties up the 20 count.
Just to explain, a hanger is when a disc doesn't quite make it to the 20 hole. Instead, it hangs precariously over the precipice. It creates something like a backboard for the opposing player. Really, it's like a layup for these guys.
Hanger 20 chance. Haggerty makes it, clinches the first game by a score of 6-4.
It's not a great start for Fortino. He hasn't carried that perfect game momentum from the semis into the finals. And Dr. Nick, he looks concerned. I ask him for another vitals check.
Could you peg a heart rate on him right now?
Let's see, like 110.
Okay, is that good or bad?
110, I would say it's a bit high for this point in the game.
Haggerty will miss short, so Fortino won't get a chance here for the perfect round unless he goes for it. Oh, yes, he makes it. Goes for the takeout and roll off a peg. Perfect round for Devin Fortino. And now we go to a third and decisive game for the World Championship Final.
Don't forget, this whole thing started almost 12 hours ago. There are 400 people, 150 tables. Now it's down to two. With the games all tied up in this first to three battle, we head into the final deciding game. This feels like the last few minutes of a tight basketball game, or it's a tie game in baseball and we're headed into the ninth inning.
I thought the nerves were getting to these players at the start of this World Championship match, but since then the play has really, really cleaned up. This is top level Crokinole, and we are tied up at 4-4. We are going to one round for all the marbles.
Now we're heading into overtime. This is extra innings. Winner takes all.
The World Crokinole champion will be determined by the winner of this next round. We are tied up at 4-4 in the third and decisive game. Sean Haggerty led 4-0 in this third game. Fortino has come back.
Can you really argue that Crokinole isn't a sport when there's a classic Cinderella story unfolding right in front of us?
Oh, it's tied up.
And he's got a hammer. This is like, you can't write this stuff better than how they're living it. This is crazy.
Devin Fortino is going to have an open 20 shot to win the world championship. At least clinch a tie. Whoa, Haggerty's going for the five. Oh, now it's an open roll into the 15 for the world championship. Devin Fortino needs a takeout on a five and to roll into the middle for the world championship title. He doesn't make it. It goes to the 10, and they tie this fifth round. We've seen fifth round tiebreakers at the World Championships before.
I mean, now we're in double overtime. This is the 14th inning.
We've never seen a sixth round tiebreaker. Devin Fortino starts the sixth round, just misses over top of the 20 hole. And Haggerty misses short, but it might be just short enough that there isn't a takeout 20 chance here for Devin Fortino. Wow, this would be a really amazing long ricochet, but Devin Fortino needs to go for it. Oh, and he went for the 20. He just misses. Haggerty, takeout, and he wins the match. Sean Haggerty, 2025 World Crokinole Champion in a thrilling championship match against Devin Fortino.
Your champion is Sean Haggerty.
I catch up with Devin. He's sweaty, disappointed.
I had a shot for the win and I blew it, so yeah. It stings a bit for sure. Overall good, but a little sour about the loss. My goal was just to make top 32, so I was very happy just making it there.
Haggerty, equally sweaty, looks genuinely elated as people gather around to congratulate him. He's won $1,000 and a small wooden trophy. He also gets to sign the board.
Out of those three things, which is the best?
I think signing the board, to be quite honest, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's some pretty amazing names on that board, and to be one of them is really super cool.
The board is the Stanley Cup of Crokinole. All the world champions have their name on it. It's been on display at the entrance of their arena all day. Today, the name Sean Haggerty will be added to the back of it. But it won't be engraved. He'll get to sign it himself. For second place, Devin gets an envelope.
Second place competitive singles and $500 and a hundreds.
Are you still gunning for your name on that board?
Yeah, I'm going to get it on there one of these days.
Nice.
That's my goal.
Before I leave, I've got to check in with John. He's here every year. He's a volunteer and he's the keeper of Crokinole lore. He's got several antique boards on display behind him. But he's standing in front of the most important board in the world of Crokinole.
So was this your idea?
Yes.
The board?
Yeah.
And how'd you come up with that?
I have no idea. I've come up with all kinds of stupid ideas. That was one of the better ones.
Right. Why the back of it rather than front?
Because I play on the other side.
Is this your board that you play on?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is the real prize for the World Championship of Canada's greatest game. There, I said it. But it doesn't go home with the winner. This is just John's board, and that board will be staying in Tavistock.
If there's one thing you would tell someone about Tavistock, what would it be?
Well, it was interesting back a couple weeks ago, and I was telling somebody, I said, I'm from Tavistock. He said, oh, the famous corners and Crokinole.
Tell me about those corners. I noticed that, like, going through.
Well, no, we can't put that language on the tape.
Well, we're not censored.
No, I don't mind them at all. They are unusual.
Yeah.
And frustrating for some.
You'd be excused if you thought Tavistock was just a small town like any other in this part of Ontario. You know, one hockey arena, one Tim Hortons, one main intersection. In other words, a four-corner town. Nope. Tavistock is actually bigger than that. There's an extra street that meets up at the center of its small downtown. Technically, that makes it a five-corner town.
It used to come from five different directions.
Right.
You know, but one's a one-way street now. So it's just one at a time. Or some of the streets they're different angles. There's nothing too straight.
It seems kind of fitting that a game which has a lot of collisions in it, a lot of, like, cross-board traffic. You know?
Hey, you're good.
Maybe I think that's the connection.
Yeah, I never thought of that.
That is your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me about it at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything that you send. Today's episode was reported by James Nicholson with additional production help from Caleb Thompson, who did the audio production and editing for this episode. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Fact check by Julian Abraham. Max Collins is Canada Land's director of audio. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. I'm Jesse Brown, and today we are talking about the news. We'll talk about the end to the Han Dong versus Global News lawsuit. But mostly, we'll talk about the punditry industrial complex and why I have actually come to miss Canada's crusty old columnists.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Wait for that. Welcome back to the show, writer and, once again, a podcaster. What's the new show called?
Gloves Off with Stephen Marsh, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow.
Wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah, I'm a natural.
That was a weak call to action. Welcome back, Stephen Marsh.
It's a good show. I will say, I don't say this often about anything that I write. I think most of what I do, you can take or leave. But I really do think everyone in Canada needs to listen to this show.
Stephen, what we're going to talk about today, it starts for us with a bit of listener email we got. Okay. This is from Chris. And Chris was concerned about this National Post columnist, Mia Hughes. Mia Hughes has been writing these pieces that are kind of like considered by some to be anti-trans pieces. I'm sure that other people have different names for it. But what was brought to our attention was like, well, who is Mia Hughes? And the bio reads, Mia Hughes specializes in researching pediatric gender medicine, psychiatric epidemics, social contagion, sort of presented as an expert, a researcher. But then we get into she's a director of GenSpect Canada.
Many of the stories these men told were likely fabricated just as a way to get the hormones and surgeries that they so desperately desired. It cannot be said often enough or strongly enough that there is no such thing as a transgender child.
GenSpect Canada is an advocacy group that also is considered anti-trans by trans people and their allies. It's been designated an anti-LGBTQ hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Jesus.
Which, you know, there's controversy about.
Yeah, right.
We're not going too deep on this one.
Although I tend to trust them. I mean, I do, but
what this brought us to talk about in the newsroom is like, huh, another National Post editorial written by a advocate.
Yeah.
An activist. Their job is not opinion columnist. Their job is I'm here to get policy changes for a certain agenda.
Yep.
Now, that's fine. Newspapers have always done that. To some degree, they've always had, like, let's hear what this special interest has to say. Let's hear what, like, even...
Yeah, no,
like,
totally.
Some
yeah.
portion of editorials have always got, you know, CEOs or politicians. Let's just hand some space over and hear from this person. That in and of itself is not so unique. But we started thinking, like, wow, the Post's editorial section looks really different than it used to.
Well, they all do. I mean, yes. It's all editorial. Like, I think it's something that's happened on the left and the right both, where, like, the columnist is essentially advocacy. That's the word for it. You know, to me, the great columnists were judges, and the new columnists are lawyers.
Right? That's interesting.
The new columnists present a case from a side.
Yeah.
A columnist, I mean, obviously, my father-in-law, Bob Fulford, who was, like, I mean, to me, he was the model of a columnist. He was like that's exactly what he was. Now, he went on different sides. He had different political convictions at different times. But he was always trying to assert what he believed to be true rather than making an argument to convince somebody else. And that's a completely different thing. That's why his only piece of advice to me ever as a columnist was that you have to be able to be fired. Right?
Uh-huh.
Which I've done amply. I've been fired by everyone at some point or another.
You were very briefly a Globe and Mail columnist?
Yeah, well, I mean, the list goes on.
Yeah.
And I think the columnist who is willing to be fired is definitely a dying breed.
That's an important nuance. And I think what I wanted to talk with you about today is nuance when we talk about opinion journalism. Mm. Because I've participated in this too, and Canada Land has participated in this too, decrying that, like, oh, reporting is expensive, opinion is cheap, there's too much opinion these days. And this is echoed. We've contributed to that kind of dichotomy, which is a bit too simplistic because there's lots of types of opinion. We're going to focus on the nuances within opinion, though.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's an interesting contradiction when you ask people, like, do you want news or opinion? They're like, I want news, I don't want opinion. And then you look at what they actually read, and it's opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
But we decided to, like, actually do an analysis of the National Post's opinion section. And what we did is We analyzed a 9-day period of editorials from 11 years ago. We chose it at random, and we compared that 9-day period in 2014 to the same 9-day calendar period this year in 2025. And we were looking at things like, how many columns were written by somebody who is, as you say, we pay this person to be a columnist. They might predictably be right-wing.
Yes. Like,
but the idea, anyhow, is they come by it honestly. They have looked at the world,
yeah,
and they have arrived at a right-wing perspective, and they're going to help you understand and analyze things, and they reserve the right to change their mind.
They pose, anyway, as honest brokers.
Let's get to the analysis, which our colleague Lucy put together for us. We found some startling things. Some stuff is, like, not surprising at all, just like papers have shrunk. So the first thing we noticed is just that they're publishing less. 11 years ago, over the course of 9 days, the National Post published 100 opinion pieces. This year, over the same period, it's down 30%. Not a huge shocker there.
Right.
Here are the things that I found most interesting. So editorials written by CEOs or other people like, I'm from a company and I have an opinion.
Yeah.
Or written by, I'm from an advocacy group. The number of editorials by those voices went up 60%.
Right. Financial pressures, I'm sure.
Back in 2014, 10% of editorials that we looked at were masthead editorials.
Right.
Where you actually have to get your editorial board together and say, what does the paper think? And what do we think is an important thing for the paper to say? And let's make sure that it's up to our standards. That was like 10% of what they published. Look at the same period in 2025, zero. They still publish masthead editorials, but in the 9 days that we looked at it, there were none.
That went really out of favor across the board.
It's true. That's considered...
People stopped doing that. And I mean, there's a reason for it. Nobody ever read them.
They're still out there.
Yeah.
But what they accomplished, and I rarely read them, but they asserted, like, this paper does have a point of view and here's what it is.
Yeah.
Which is sort of like a transparency measure, and it gives you some insight.
And of course, if you said the wrong thing, then suddenly you got a whole bunch of canceled subscriptions.
Yeah, right? I don't want to support a paper that supports this or doesn't support
that. Like the New York
that.
Times just did one about the mayoral race that they got crucified for.
Yes.
And I bet they're thinking to themselves, why on earth did we do that?
The number of editorials written by experts, it went down by 40%. And then here's something we noticed that is not quantifiable the same way, but diversity of voices in the National Post. In this week that we happened to look at, they ran a Glenn Greenwald editorial.
Right.
Can you
sure.
imagine the National Post running something by Glenn Greenwald? Stephen Maher writing stuff against the Harper government. David Mosgrop, Max Fawcett was writing. So
they were a great op-ed section.
They really did have a deep roster. In addition to stalwarts like Christy Blatchford, Barbara and Jonathan Kay, Conrad Black, Rex Murphy, Robert Fulford, they also had people who I think are not as quickly associated with National Post opinionators. People like Andrew Coyne, Robin Urbach, Stephen Maher.
Newspapers go through cycles with this stuff. I mean, the Globe and Mail right now, their op-ed section is fantastic.
Yeah.
Natasha Azan and Mark Medley and those guys, I mean, they really have got it into very good shape. And if you look at them 10 years ago, there's just no way.
The Post came onto the scene as like, the Globe is gray and boring and it's just telling you what the right thinking way is.
Yeah.
We're going to give you, like, they had like columns by like everybody from Wayne Gretzky to like Jonathan Goldstein had one. And, you know, they had funny columns and cultural columns and they had authors and they had Rebecca Eckler doing her like,
right.
I don't know, like young
right.
sexy girl call. I don't know.
Right.
They were like really.
Yummy mummy.
Yeah.
And, all those columns.
And then, in opinion, they were looking to have, like, a clash of ideas.
Yeah, was, right.
That was a signature thing of the Post.
Yeah.
Now it's interesting. You bring up the money thing. We know the National Post is, like, cut to the bone. And I think that what you have now, and this is, like, my analysis of our analysis, it's the cheapest thing you could possibly do. Because when you don't want to pay for a full-time columnist, you then go to freelance, which is, like, you still got to find the freelancer, edit them.
You got to talk to people like me. I'm annoying and I'm surprising.
And then here's what you can do instead. You don't have to pay the columnist, or more expensively, you don't have to pay for like your editor to like edit and find the columnist.
Yeah.
You just basically hand over the space. And a newspaper like the National Post can just become like, look, if your opinions are in line with our general mindset and you have a job of spreading the word about something, you can throw a National Post masthead over what you have to say, and it's free content for us. That's the harshest way of looking at it.
That's obviously got to be part of it. But I wonder, too, if it's not like we've just entered a period where what audiences expect is straight advocacy. You know, like we came through this hard left-wing period of literally I'm a writer activist. That was more common than I'm a writer.
Yeah.
Like I was like, I'm a writer. I'm not an advocate. That's like my source of pride.
Yeah, and you had young people whose source of pride was I got this radical opinion into the paper.
Exactly.
And it's like, okay, but how did you say it? Did you convince anyone? Did you make any interesting points? Was it read? It was almost like this like I moved the mainstream towards us.
And I think you see it at the CBC, where it's basically like PR for progressive causes. Right? Like, that's what we're doing. It's not necessarily journalism in the sense of, like, trying to figure out what's actually happening and what might be the right way to think about it. It's like, let's pick the cause, and then we'll find a story that fits that cause, right? The other thing is, I wonder if that's what readers want, because to me, that's what Substack does, right? Like, what Substack does is it narrowcasts your audience into such a way that you're constantly feeding this beast, and you really can't escape the cause, the advocacy that you're doing. Like, if you ever look at, like, the Free Press now, like, it's such a joke, right? Like, it's such an unbelievable joke. It's like, you're talking about human liberty. You don't mention secret police rounding up immigrants randomly on the streets of Los Angeles. Instead, you talk about things that you know is red meat to your base, right? My only point here is the financial reasons are part of it, but you would know better than me because you've sort of been in this space for a lot longer, and I'm just a freelancer who occasionally has hits. Like, the audience kind of expects advocacy. That's kind of what they're looking for in a certain sense.
Well, you've conflated two completely, well, not completely unrelated, but pretty unrelated things, but they're both interesting. I suspect that if you looked at the actual data in the papers of these, like, they're the most boring columns ever written, the ones that are written by CEOs and advocates. I don't think that that's
what
the audience...
Well, why would you read them? I mean, you could just look at their title and you know what they're going to say.
So I don't think that that's what's driving that. I think what's driving that is just disappearing freelance budgets. I think it's just empty column space. You know, the Post has two columnists who basically specialize in attacking trans communities. Like, you know, but does the audience love them? I don't know. I would suspect...
Well, clearly, they have two.
I think that if you're going to outsource stuff and give away the column space, maybe that's the best topic you could do. But I think that ultimately there was a reason why people like Christy Blatchford got paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
People would subscribe to one paper over the other based on which columnist they like to read.
100%.
I don't think that that's being replaced with these kind of farmed out pieces. Go over to Substack and it's much closer to the relationship that people had to Christy Blatchford.
Yeah. Christy Blatchford's, it's sort of different than what I would think of as like the columns, like once a week columns.
But Barry Weiss is a great example. That's a very good Christy Blatchford corollary. Like people were like, you know what? I like Barry Weiss, the New York Times. I'm going to follow her over here.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get into the audience capture question, which... I could write an editorial or a book about and call myself an expert. Escaping audience capture is...
is that the title of your memoir? See, if I've always feared that enormously.
I think that it depends on how you built your audience. If you built your audience as this is a response to woke hysteria, then that's what they want you to do. They want you to beat up on woke hysteria every day. And you're not allowed to say, but on the other hand...
Exactly.
Know.
Maybe this doesn't matter anymore now that there are, like, secret police on the streets of America.
Yeah.
That's what I've always feared, right? But, you know, the way to build an audience is obviously outrage, right? And obviously, like, these rage mechanics, these are the attention mechanisms that work.
You're outraging me. That's the dumbest thing to say. The way to build an audience is outrage. No, that's a way to build an audience, and I think that it's a very shallow and conditional attachment.
It's called newspapers.
Right.
Like, it's like called the press. Like, it is shallow.
You are a fellow podcaster now, and you're a writer. We're not trying to build shallow audiences. We're trying to build audiences that spend 30, 40 minutes with us.
Yeah.
And audiences...
Well, I have no strategy, clearly. Like, that, like I'm very...
Well, you're coming on Canada Land. That's a perfect tactic.
Yeah. That's tactics I might have. Strategy I don't.
Stephen Marsh, we want people to pay attention to stories that matter. I would like to duly note an outcome of a major news story that we talked about for hours and hours and hours, and everybody talked about for days and weeks, the Handong story.
Oh, yes.
The outcomes, they never get as much attention. We have an outcome, and I have something to say about it. Now, everyone remembers that this is what kicked off the whole foreign interference thing, is Sam Cooper reporting for Global News, information that he had from sources at CSIS. They said that they were trying to get the government to give a shit about foreign interference.
Right.
Trudeau didn't give a shit. So they started leaking to the press.
Too nice. Why would anyone hurt us?
Inquiries, policy changes, everything that's happened can be traced back to this story that Sam Cooper filed for Global News about Handong. And Handong sued, and now that lawsuit has been settled.
Did he win? Or no, it's just been settled out of court.
That's a very good question. What does it mean when something is settled? According to some people, this is vindication for Handong.
Okay.
I'm open to lots of points of view. We published senior journalist Bruce Livesey, who felt like the whole foreign interference thing was overblown. Others who are kind of like Trudeau cheerleaders, like this guy Dean Blundell and this guy Tyler Meredith. I'm picking a few people who have large audiences who are essentially saying, we told you, lying fake media, I'm paraphrasing here. This is the vindication of Handong. Huh. So If you know how to read these things.
Which you do.
Which I do. Here's what you will note in the statement that Global News released. And the statement is something that is negotiated between lawyers.
Right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. It's the key.
And the wording has to be agreed to by both parties. So previously, Han Dong said, when he was suing, that Global News needed to apologize and retract. And until they do, this is a quote, until they do, I will fight to clear my name in the courts. So there's no apology.
Really?
There's no retraction. There's not even a correction or a, or a clarification.
Mm.
So the article that started all of this stands.
They haven't 404'd it.
It hasn't been disappeared. You can go read it. And Han Dong accepted that. In accepting this settlement, he accepted. I'm sure that he wanted it removed.
Uh-huh.
He didn't get that. The settlement means he's not going to sue again. This is part of the public record.
Right.
And that's what a settlement means. It's, it will remain so. Global News stood by their story at the beginning.
Right.
And there's nothing to indicate that they don't stand by it now. I don't know what happened behind the scenes here, but what often happens is you get to the point where the guy who's suing indicates that maybe he's ready to settle.
Right.
And you say, well, we're not apologizing, we're not retracting.
Right.
Well, can you say something? What are you willing to say? So the statement is that Global News recognizes the outcomes of the inquiry and basically just repeats some information that they were not able to find that Han Dong actually said that they should keep the two Michaels in prison. You know, and
I see.
Global News accepts that. Yeah. They never said otherwise. The Global News story was always, we have sources in CSIS who say that that's what this phone call was about. They're very clear about that. So I am a little bit askance at the notion that this is a victory for Han Dong. And
wasn't the point of a settlement everyone gets to say it's a victory?
Or nobody.
And no, yeah, and everyone walks away.
Here's what Han Dong said. Quote, yes, I confirm that the case is settled. After two long years, finally my family and I can move on. I have had a profound appreciation of the privilege of holding a public office and being a member of the Liberal caucus. Nothing in there about how this was false from the start. Nothing in there about this proves that I was right from the start. Nothing in there about now I can resume serving constituents. Mm-hmm. Nothing, nothing, nothing. I can tell you from some experience that when you get to the negotiating table stage of this thing, both parties want to claim victory and crow about it. And the fact that neither of them is doing so is something that was, I can't state this for a fact, but I strongly suspect that is something that was agreed to.
Well, as you said at the beginning, if you hadn't brought this up on this show, this statement probably would never appear in anyone's consciousness in Canada.
And I just want to remind people, if you are a journalist who gets sued by a politician, this is kind of like the best you could hope for. Because like, it's very rare that you're going to go the distance, go to trial, that your insurer is going to pay for you to go to trial, and then you're going to be vindicated by the court. The point here, I think, for a Canadian newsreader is that the substance of the central charge that something up was happening in Canada with foreign interference has been vindicated and validated again and again and again. And that began with this Global News reporting. And that includes the National Security Intelligence Committee of Parliamentarians report that Canadian MPs were helping foreign governments interfere in Canada's democratic process. The Hogue inquiry called for widespread reforms to party nomination processes like the one that Han Dong. And when I see reporters, I haven't been keeping up with Sam Cooper's stuff lately, I'll admit, I'm not like here to...
Was that the reporter?
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not here, I'll analyze and criticize this stuff like I will anyone else's, but I don't think the guy's won an award for that. Like, that's a major story, foreign interference, and it was a real story. And
well, nobody wins awards for the pieces that really matter.
No, I guess not.
I mean, no. Like, they win awards for pieces that nobody reads that are set aside just to win awards.
The disassembling of this to somehow spin this into a vindication that Sam Cooper was wrong from the start,
It's not there, right?
It's not there.
Duly noted.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. I chat with our supporters on Discord. I post now and then on Blue Sky. Stephen Marsh, where can people find you or your new podcast?
My new podcast is Gloves Off with Stephen Marsh. They can find it anywhere they get their podcasts.
And they should.
And they should. And they should subscribe. And if they want to email me, I'm at stephenmarsh@gmail.com.
This episode is produced by James Nicholson. Our associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier, who also did the fact check. Mixing and mastering by Tristan Capicchione. Our director of audio at Canada Land is Max Collins, and I am our editor and publisher. Our theme music is by So Cold. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca.